This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymph. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakweowasan, we are all related.
Hee-haw! Hello, everybody. It's Benjamin the Donkey.
Hi, Benji. I'm glad you showed up today to help me wrap up with the Barry Snyder interview.
You know, lately people are talking about the new normal. Fires in forests, we've learned, have increased and we should be concerned. But to not misinform, it's only the norm until all the trees there have burned. Hee-haw!
I know, right? I imagine with the massive fires over the past month or so, the folks north of the border in British Columbia are thinking the world is coming to an end. I don't understand how people can imagine our impending extinction will be due to another ice age. First of all, there is paleoclimatology evidence to indicate that humans didn't do too badly during the previous ice ages, despite not having an abundant, convenient way to heat their homes. And second, the only thing that's keeping us from continuing to break high temperature records is that El Niño is asleep. Yet even so, we're looking at an ice-free Arctic by this September at the latest, don't you think?
Fire and ice. Some say the world ends in fire, some in ice, should people inquire. What we know now's concise. Though ice might be nice, the world will be ending in fire. Hee-haw!
Exactly. But I'm going to put off talking about the fire situation until after the eclipse. Today, I want to talk about Barry's other perspective as an astrological seeker and the essay he wrote at his website, luminousself.com. He did a chart for the eclipse and a chart for Donald Trump, and he found some remarkable interactions, correspondences, and overlaps.
You know, this is what I was thinking before Trump won the election. There's no way of stopping the waning of life in the time that's remaining. But elections, we know, are a circus clown show, so they might as well be entertaining. With statements so clearly severe, his campaign will one day disappear. As most people say, he won't go all the way, so enjoy him and life while they're here. Hee-haw!
I was not a Hillary Clinton supporter. I wasn't even a Berniac. Like most people, I was more than a little bit nervous when Trump ended up winning the election, and I would have been nervous if Clinton had won too. I'm very nervous about the direction that this country has taken, no matter who's sitting in the Oval Office. But the fact that it was Trump, that it was somebody so blatant rather than somebody more subtle like Clinton, that blatantness has been in its own right a catalyst.
So interesting to me how Donald Trump's chart, who has been this incredible personage, to coalesce so much stuff around. You know, I mean, he has catalyzed so much. You got to give him credit. I mean, He's a movement out of the collective unconscious to bring this guy forth.
I knew it when the Washington Post started owning climate change just because Trump was denying, you know. And that to me was enough, you know. That was consolation enough. You know, Elizabeth West spoke to that very much in the article that she wrote for Counterpunch that inspired me to have her on the show when we did Earthbound. He is our mirror in which we get to examine our cultural shadow and come to terms with it. And
getting back to Trump, though, his chart, when it overlay, you put it overlay it on this eclipse chart, is phenomenal. And anyone's listening to this, if you want to really go into this more in depth, I did quite an article on this. It's on our blog. Go to luminousself.com, and it's the first item on the blog if you really want to dive into this.
Hee-haw, hee-haw.
Yeah, I know. Astrology is not my science either, but nor do I put much stock in what other scientists are saying since they are owned by their corporate sponsors. Meanwhile, all I see from the media is infotainment, as if the eclipse is the featured event in some cosmic talent show and tickets are free. So I'm prepared to give a listen to anyone who speaks their truth without being paid. So, astrology. When doing a person's chart, the location on the planet where they were born is an important consideration, since that's what establishes the perspective from which the planetary energies can act. Similarly, the chart for an event is tied to a time and a location. But how does one choose a location for a solar eclipse when it has a band of totality some 70 miles wide that stretches across a continent? Barry solved that problem in a brilliant and intuitive way. He chose Ferguson, Missouri as his focal point, since it is located fairly close to the geographic center of the band of totality. Being located where it is, and with events in its recent history, it stands as a nexus of one of the major cultural wounds that needs healing in this country, a wound that results from one of the major national character flaws responsible for so much of our coast-to-coast dysfunction, from embattled communities oppressed by municipal police indistinguishable from an occupying army, to the school-to-prison pipeline, to the prison-industrial complex itself. This is not to say that there is more racism in Ferguson than elsewhere, but by virtue of the synergy between its geographic location and recent socio-political events, I believe Barry made a highly suitable choice. So, Barry, if you would, please explain in terms that the astrologically ignorant can understand, what were your most salient findings?
The ascendant is your personality, is your outward expression, is your most direct outward expression of your personality into the world. He has Mars on his ascendant in Leo on the fixed star of Regulus, which is like the dominant Leoan kingly archetype. That's what you see in this guy. So he represents this Leoan aspect, this solar aspect, the fiery male kingly type. And it's blown up for everybody to see. He doesn't know how to lose. He doesn't know how to be humble. Or possibly it's hidden in his subconscious. And this eclipse is happening right on his ascendant and right on that Mars. And here he is, the president of the world's most powerful country, bristling with nuclear weapons, threatening North Korea, who has a similarly questionable person running that country, sanctioning basically the Soviets, the Russians this week said, we are convinced that there's, you know, no more dealing with the U.S. and that they are planning preemptive nuclear war with us. So look at this cauldron that is boiling here. Mars is aggression, is personal will, it's domination at a human level. Here comes Trump. Here comes his eclipse. It's going to amplify. It's going to be shining right on that stuff. What are we going to get? Are we going to get his shadow? Are we going to get his soul? I don't know. I'm deeply concerned because he is being cordoned in by the deep state. He's being so shackled and handcuffed.
Hee-haw. You know what they say about those who don't learn history. Those who don't study about how Nazis developed their clout are now doomed to repeat with a front row seat what they didn't already find out. Hee-haw.
But Benji, Trump is a great student of Hitler, just like Brown Limper Stafford in L. Ron Hubbard's epic science fiction novel, Battlefield Earth. Maybe instead of studying how the Nazis developed their clout, aspiring world dominators should pay more attention to how the Nazis lost their clout.
The impeachment articles have been put into Congress for him. They want to take him down. My concern is that that ego does not know losing and that he will strike out somehow against Korea or do something completely barometric, which is his nature, that could be quite wild.
Well, that's actually a very commonplace strategy to boost presidential popularity, because if he really is our shadow, he's not reflecting anything to us that doesn't also exist in us as a culture.
Yes.
There's no surprise here. Americans don't know how to lose.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I'm really glad you're bringing this home, because we don't want to make this about Trump. And I think that's the error everybody has made here, instead of seeing that he's a giant Rorschach to show us our shadow.
Yes.
And if we can see that and realize what we have to do each individually, and the word is humility, really going to that more feminine side. And it's about being humble, getting back to the basics, getting back to what's sustainable at a human level on this planet. Putin wants to talk to us. He wants to have more of a global community. You know, he wants to dialogue. We're not even allowing that.
I think your blog was dated like the 20th of July, so maybe we've moved forward from there. But you posed the question, quote, what if Trump and Putin were to consciously unify their efforts? Such an allegiance could set the stage for one of the most significant planetary shifts in recorded history. Unquote. I'd love to hear you say a little bit more about what such a shift might look like in your wildest dreams.
In the wildest dreams is that Trump and Sanders, that they were able to rise up as far as politics as they did, were both signs that Americans were tired of the no-party system, the two-party system that's one party.
I call it the Republicratic Party.
Exactly. The deep state. Basically, this country has been controlled by a hidden shadow government called the deep state, whatever you want to call it, for decades. Trump was not initially part of that. He got elected president. I don't know how. I think they probably figured out they could co-opt him and use him. But during the election process, the campaigning process, he talked about this New World Order stuff. He's aware. He knows it's going on. Putin knows it's going on. Putin stopped it. When Putin came to power in Russia in the 90s, he threw the oligarchs out. They were basically wanted to do to Russia what they've done to every country. They want to go in, take over, strip it of its assets, put it deeply in debt, and make it controlled by this New World Order crowd. They were trying to get to Russia. Putin got wind of that, knew what was going on, and he's defeated that whole thing. He stopped it. There's plenty of stuff you can read about this, but my hope was that Trump could see the den of snakes he was in and go to Putin and say, we can stop this together collectively by saying we're going to stop this confrontive approach that continues to build more armaments, more weaponry, create more fear. It's all about creating fear to move us towards this new world order.
It's about protecting privilege, too. The difference is Putin is a Russian, and they're basically, from our perspective at least, barbarians.
That's how we see it.
Yeah, and Trump is American and privileged and soft.
That's the whole idea.
And definitely addicted to his privileged lifestyle. And he's not going to be willing to step back. Just as you were saying, he hates to lose. The flip side of that is he loves to win. So if they're going to dump the presidency in his lap, then he's won and he's going to be happy and he'll go ahead and kiss up to them and do whatever they tell him to do, I guess they figure.
They own him. They've co-opted him.
So do you think that this eclipse energy, this transformational energy from the eclipse might be powerful enough to penetrate through his thick orange skin?
You can still hope. I don't care whether you believe in sending energy or praying, or doing whatever, doing rituals, but that's the ritual I'm going to be doing, or the prayers I'm going to be sending out, that may he awaken. May this being awaken to something deeper within him. They just passed those sanctions on Russia this week. There's only like 8 people in all of Congress that voted against it.
Really?
Yes. The lies about the whole thing prevailed. So now we're sitting in this polar opposition to Russia. And it's all about energy. It's all about gas pipelines in Europe. It's all about money. They're trying to cripple Russia. They're trying to cripple and subvert Russia so that Russia is no longer a factor to keep them from foisting this one world government on us. You can't have sovereign, powerful nations to create a one world government. You can't have a strong Russia or a strong United States. Their plan has been to destroy the sovereignty of the U.S. That is why they put us $20 trillion in debt, why they've done all the things they've done.
I was about to point out that has already been accomplished.
Been accomplished.
Because this is not a democracy, it's a corporatocracy. And governments don't really run the world. Corporations do.
Yeah.
You know, inflation's what we should abhor. Weimar's curious, forgotten lore. Ironically funny, we've more and more money, but nothing's worth shit anymore. Europe and the United States soon will set negative rates. As things go downhill, all worth becomes nil, but keep inking those printing plates. Yeehaw!
And the people behind them, Google, Bilderberg Group, Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, the world as a large monopoly board for a few people who have no national allegiances whatsoever.
Exactly.
They buy and sell countries like you buy and sell Park Place and Boardwalk in Monopoly. I think we're at the cruxial moment. The immense crisis is right in front of us. And I think this eclipse could be one of the triggers to that. The Rothschilds own a magazine called The Economist. They're so arrogant, they tell you their plan subtly long before they actually do it. 20 years ago, they put an image on the front of it. They showed a picture of an eagle rising out of ashes with a pile of dollar bills burning underneath it and a medallion around its neck with a new world currency, 2018.
And this came out when?
In The Economist magazine, 1998, I believe.
98, okay.
You know, if not learning the past's what you do, you'll repeat what folks had to go through. But with history's view, it's regrettably true. You're still doomed to repeat it now, too. Hee-haw!
Well, I did the best I could. I did the research and found that magazine cover. However, it was not from 1998. The 1998 date belonged to a retrospective blog entry. The original cover was dated 9 January 1988. And the article attributes the original idea to a Harvard economist from 1984. According to this view, there can be no world government without a world currency.
They have been planning to initiate a one world government, which would have one central bank with one global currency, which is going to be called the special drawing rights. This is all planned. I've been reading into this, and they're planning on doing it next year.
But I can't get too hyped about the arguments, either for or against, because whether currency, computer bits, plastic beads, or gold, you can't eat it, drink it, wear it, live in it, or make love to it. In other words, it has no intrinsic value.
Collapse of the U.S. economy this year, later this year, probably. It's all bubbling, bubbling, bubbling. That's my guess. This is just Barry's guess, but it's not just Barry's. There's a lot of other people who are very much more wise and knowing than Barry that believe this, that I've read, and I agree with them. So I think it's all coming to a head, and this eclipse could be the trigger event because, again, it's this Leoan solar principle, Trump being the archetype of that, which is now being shadowed. The shadow of that can come up now to be seen more clearly, I think.
So if he's going to have this shift, this awakening of a new consciousness, I'm trying to figure out, trying to put myself in his shoes, being that empath, right?
Yeah.
What could possibly be more important to Donald Trump than Donald Trump?
His family. The man has much cancer in his chart. It's really interesting. You notice how his family has always been close to him. Yeah, he's very, well, sound judgmental, very self-involved. No question about that, right? But I think part of his self-involvement is his family. I think he does care about his family. And I think he does have moon and another planet, Jupiter, I think, that are in Cancer in his chart, very predominantly. And they're also aspected heavily in this eclipse that could really cause another part of him, a more that nurturing side of him. He has a sun-moon opposition in his chart.
It means what to his family affiliations?
he's trying to integrate the sun, moon, or the masculine, feminine aspect in his being. That's why he has these women around him, why Ivanka is so close to him.
They make a big deal out of the fact that they won't hold hands in public. So what does that say about his closeness to his family and his women around him?
Yeah, I think he's probably trying to maintain some kind of sense of his own sovereignty and that he's not relying on them or fused with them, emotionally bonded to them in a way that would compromise him. That's just my own guess. But, you know, getting back to the eclipse, what it could be that some little part in his soul will realize that playing along with this game, even though it keeps giving him power as the Leo and kingly figure, is basically going to destroy the very country and the people that he cares about, and maybe the world.
So you think the Make America Great Again is actually a sincere expression of his identification with this culture as opposed to the New World Order?
I believe so. I believe that's where it started out for him. You know, and to make America great, you know, he sees that as I'm going to restore industry and jobs. And
I'm very confused, actually, because during the campaign, it seemed to me that he was much more isolationist.
He was. He was a Hoover Coolidge. I think he really is. I think that's who Donald Trump is. I think that's his real nature. But he got into this rat's nest of people in the executive branch. He couldn't find anybody as his advisors, except a few that were, they were neoconservatives. They were out of the whole Project for New American Century ilk that Cheney and all those guys that were part of that.
You know, Donald Trump had staffing problems even back in the days of Celebrity Apprentice. Because he liked saying you're fired, he ran short of help as folks expired. Though he looked the whole season, he failed. And the reason? No one was left to be hired. Hee-haw!
The whole idea was to destroy America as a sovereign entity. All the outsourcing, all the taking all the industry out of this country, that's all been a long-term plan to put, and put the country so deeply in debt that it would go bankrupt. And then we would lose the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. When that happens, it's all over. The U.S. economy collapses.
Bring it on.
But it's going to be very difficult.
It is going to be difficult and also very necessary.
I agree with you. I agree. It's absolutely essential. That's our hope, that what it will do is then we'll get grounded again and realize, hey, we got to learn how to take care of each other, make sure that everybody has food, shelter, and the basics. And I think Donald understood that. He grew up in the 50s. The society's become so economically polarized. You know, people can't make it. I watch here on this farm what's happened to these kids that are in their 20s. They have to live with their parents. They cannot go out and make it on their own. I think Trump sees that. And I think he sees what that's doing to the fabric of our culture. I think he really did want to change that. And now I think he realizes he's up against forces that want to make it worse, that want to have that result in, you know, the Hegelian dialectic of divide and conquer and create such polarizations and splits in this country that it goes into chaos and, you know, is subject to martial law or all kinds of incredible things could happen out of that. I think he knows that.
Wars tend to stimulate the economy, though. He grew up in the 50s and a single income family could make it back then. We were in the post-World War II industrial boom. That's what he wants to bring back when he says, make America great again.
I think he wants to bring back real industry. We don't have any real industry anymore. He wants to bring it back so that we actually make things here, produce things here. He grew up in a time when family was sustainable, when our culture was more sustainable. He wants that in the ways that he might project that to be, but that's a deeper part of him speaking. That's his soul speaking. And we can only hope that that wakes up, that somehow that awakens and he realizes that what he's being asked to do now is going to absolutely destroy this country and potentially destroy the world.
Okay, well, that's a very nice empathy segment for Donald Trump. I'm really appreciating that. It wasn't what I signed up for this evening, but same thing happened the last time we met. The diversions are often the juiciest part of the conversation. So let me just take a breath here for a minute. And once again, offer you my heartfelt gratitude for your work in the world and for your unique spin on current events as they relate to events in the cosmos. Coming up in the second half of Sequitur Solar Science 2B, we've got Elizabeth West standing by with a sunset windows practice called Your Script. What you're hearing in the background is the opening of a 1995 song by Zimp to take us to the station break. This is "And the Stucco Ceiling Said..."
Listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
Before the break, you heard "And the Stucco Ceiling Said," a song by Zimpf from 1995. And now, it is my pleasure to turn over the mic to Elizabeth West. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Susan. This week's practice is called Your Script, and it's a very simple practice. It's so simple that you might be tempted to dismiss it out of hand. So I want to begin by acknowledging that while there's nothing particularly mystical at all about this one, it actually can be rather magical. That's my experience anyway. It can shift a great deal in those of us who engage in it with wholehearted intent. So the core of the focus here is awareness and how you direct that awareness. This is the realm where infinite choice remains for all of us, even in these times, where power lies and where the life that you want can still be accessed. There are many things that are beyond our control, as we know. In fact, most things are not in the sphere of our control. This has always been so, but the veils have tended to obscure that reality. It's been possible for just ages to imagine that our mind in this incarnation is what determines our physical fate, what job we have, how our kids do, whether we live under a bridge or in a mansion. These are elements of free will in our lives, certainly, but by and large, we've been less in charge of things than we generally prefer to think. Now, the enticing but not very real notion of self-determination is being exposed as wars expand and jump the lines, as the ice caps melt and the earth starts to explode. It's here and now. With that recognition advancing on all of us, that it is essential that we take our free will and use it where it actually operates, where it can make a difference in our lives. I probably can't do anything about Fukushima or about the drought or the mega storms that counter the droughts, but we can choose who we want to be, whether things are going perfectly around us or whether we're in the midst of a disaster. This is a critical realm and the one where we have both agency and choice if we decide to exercise them. And that, of course, is the nub of it, exercise. Thinking about lifting weights builds very little muscle mass, and considering being joyful and fully present has about the same impact on your level of happiness. Some might say that contemplation is the first step toward making change, and this is often true. However, the point here is to encourage you to action, no matter how simple and small. The guides who have downloaded this practice want to encourage us to do more than listen to what they have to say. If you want to feel better, if you want to have a richer and more joyful moment-to-moment time, then this is a process that might help you get there. So this is how this one goes. It's like the others, very simple. First thing in the morning, sit quietly for a moment with your eyes closed, breathe deeply, and allow yourself to find a quality that you want to experience more of in your day, in this day. Joy, patience, gratitude, truth, courage. These are just some possibilities to get you started. Just be sure to think in terms of experiences that you can hold within rather than those which are dictated by externals. In other words, there's a difference between celebrating or seeing the abundance that already exists in your life or wanting to see that abundance, looking for greater abundance. What we want to do here with this practice is cultivate some quality that you can cultivate on your own without the rest of the world making an offering. Once you've chosen that which you want to focus on for the day, write the word with your non-dominant hand in a deliberate manner 7 times. Just make a list and write that quality, that one word, with your non-dominant hand 7 times. And after that, give yourself permission to have and to notice that quality as it appears throughout the course of your day. Before you go to bed at night, take out your pad where you've written this quality and write the same word on the same page, perhaps on a right-hand column as opposed to a left-hand column. Write it with your dominant hand, allowing yourself as you do so to reflect on how your intention manifested itself during the day. Although there's a similarity between this practice and the use of affirmations, this actually works with a different faculty. And by going through these steps, using your body, using your hands, you bring the aspect of your life you choose to increase into focus in a grounded and ultimately in a corporeal manner. So that's it. You write the quality that you want with your non-dominant hand 7 times in the morning, and you write it 7 times with your dominant hand in the evening, and you watch in between and see what happens. What happened for me, I found this to be one of the most extraordinary practices. It showed me a really simple and direct correlation between that which I wrote in the morning and that which graced my day. Sometimes this was very clear. I chose to cultivate more peace, for instance, and at frequent intervals throughout the day, I was conscious of how much peace I was experiencing despite the events and demands I couldn't escape. I found this very, very exciting, actually. to have such a simple means for accessing the power to craft the way my life was going, no matter what was happening around me. But one morning, I sat down to consider the quality I wanted for the day, and I felt a surge of delight when I touched into the idea of being generous. That just felt so right. I was so excited. And I decided to go with that, and I wrote generous 7 times with my left hand. So I went through my day, and the concept of generosity was with me, but I started to notice as it arose that something was wrong, something was amiss, just didn't feel quite right. And so with a little more attention, I found myself face to face with the fact that sometimes I'm dishonest in my generosity. Sometimes I give because I think that's who I am or who I really want to be. I sometimes give of myself or from myself because it's aligned and correct. It is an authentic offering sometimes. But other times, apparently, I give because it's ingrained in me that generosity is admirable and desirable. And underneath that, I resent it. I resent it when I do it for those reasons. And so when I resent it, it doesn't flow out of my truth. So when that started to make itself apparent to me, I went back to my pad of paper and wrote honesty with my left hand 7 times. And for the remainder of the day, I was really conscious of being honest with myself, particularly in the areas where giving of myself was concerned. And I was able to make some really pretty beautiful shifts in awareness. I found myself going into generosity only when it was an honest expression and offering from my heart. So I really have gleaned and garnered a great deal from using this simple practice. And it has given me a lot of strength and power to see myself and also to kind of direct the way that I want to live in the world, even when it's not always going my way. So I hope it has some of the power and some of the richness for others as it's had for me.
What came up for me as you were describing that practice was some curiosity about the idea of using your non-dominant hand to create an intention for bringing some quality into your life. And I'm wondering what the neurological effect of that is.
I can't speak to the science of it, Susan, but my sense about it is that if we want to bypass our usual mental patterns, we have to do things differently.
Bypass our usual physical patterns.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. And what gave you the inspiration to do that, to use the non-preferred hand to write down a quality? That just seems like a really out in left field idea.
I mean, these are not my ideas. These were channeled. These were given, you know, handed down to me. I'm the translator. So it's not like I dreamed this up. But my experience of working with it is that for me to write with my left hand requires a kind of concentration that allows me to really be present with what I'm writing in a certain way that I wouldn't be if I was writing with my right hand.
You bypass the focus.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's an almost an automatic kind of activity. And using the non-dominant hand really requires that you be present and pay attention in a different kind of way. And I also think something happens, which I don't know the mechanism for, but I do think that by using a part of our body or using a body in a different way than we're accustomed to, we do create a new kind of pathway, which will either show up or it won't show up if you try it. But for me, it definitely showed up. It was a very interesting and powerful.
So what came up for me when you were talking about the automatic nature of writing with your preferred hand is this thing that's happening in today's world with a focus on computer forms. They're not teaching script. They're not teaching joined up writing in school anymore. So I think some of that flow, some of the preference for the preferred hand is going to be dissipated through confining our upcoming generations to print, you know, discrete characters rather than the flow of automatic writing. Can you speak to that at all?
Well, I can just say that it makes me very sad. I have a great deal of appreciation for how quickly we can communicate with words, with written words, using computers, but there's nothing for me like writing. It's, you know, I mean, I love a pen, a good pen. and a book to write in. It's an experience that has more dimensions than using a computer. And, you know, just like holding a book is different than reading on a computer screen.
Which in turn is different from reading on a smartphone.
Indeed.
There's an enormous, I think, I'm putting myself into your segment here. I believe that this is a very, very deprived generation that's coming up now that connects with the world through a device held in the hand.
It's very small. It's very limiting in a lot of ways. Even though it opens up access to many things, I think it's very limiting.
It opens access to many things, and it deprives of intimacy, of connection with those things.
Exactly. It does.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I wrote down in my notes here from my background in perceptual psychology, people who are right-handed are very, very lateralized. People who are left-handed are less so. And then, of course, there's that tiny little tip of the iceberg that's actually ambidextrous.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine that this practice would be more effective for right-handed people than for left-handed or ambidextrous people?
I can imagine it might be, and I would be interested to hear if it is.
Because it's not as much of a handicap. I'm left-handed, and I'm not mm-hmm. lateralized. I found out from psychological tests when I was in graduate school. I'm wondering if there would be as much of a discrepancy for me between the morning part of the practice and the evening part of the practice as there would be for you.
Exactly. So it's an excellent question, and I'll be interested to hear if you try it.
Well, I hope our listeners will give us some feedback on that too, if any of them are in that remarkable category of ambidexterity. Well, okay. Thank you for your script. I will certainly try it. I'm very intrigued by it, and I will certainly give it a try.
All right. Well, let us know how it goes.
You bet. Okay. Bye for now.
See you, Susan. Bye-bye.
You just heard Your Script, the second segment in the Sunset Windows series by Elizabeth West. Before I sign off, I've got some last-minute instructions on viewing the eclipse. I trust you have your protective eyewear in place and know when and where to go, but the commercial hype about the event has been lacking in information about astronomical features other than the sun that will be apparent in the darkened sky. So with a shout-out to Tom McMullen of Abingdon, Virginia for the heads-up, here are some excerpts from Eddie Irizarry, first posted on 14 March in Astronomy Essentials. You'll easily be able to see four planets with the unaided eye near the eclipsed sun. In order of brightness, they are Venus, Jupiter, Mars, and Mercury. About 15 to 30 minutes before totality, Venus will gradually become clearly visible just to the west of the darkening sun. Look for Jupiter, almost as bright, farther away and to the southeast of the sun. About 30 seconds before totality, Mars will show up between Venus and the sun as a faint orange dot. At a similar apparent distance on the opposite side of the sun will be Mercury, at about the same brightness, but not so orange. It will get dark enough to pick out some of the brighter stars, too. To the southeast of the sun will be Sirius, the brightest star. The next brightest stars are Capella to the northeast of the sun, north of Sirius, and Arcturus to the northwest of the sun, north of Jupiter. To the east of an imaginary line between Venus and Sirius will be Orion, a great favorite of mine. The brightest star in that constellation is Rigel. You probably know that the sun is in Leo at this time of the year, and you might be able to pick out Regulus, Leo's brightest star, peeking out from behind the sun's western corona. In closing, I offer my best wishes for safe and satisfying viewing, and I join Irizarry in advising that you spend less time capturing the eclipse and more time experiencing it, being fully present to it, so that it can do its transformational work. There will be so many pictures taken by robots. Why sacrifice these brief moments to fiddling with technology? That's it for now. Thanks to special guest Barry Snyder for his fascinating analysis of the astrological implications of the upcoming solar eclipse for the Trump presidency and the current geopolitical situation. To contributor Elizabeth West for Your Script, the second Sunset Windows practice, to Benjamin the Donkey for his sometimes irreverent but always enlightened commentary, and to Zimth for "And the Stucco Ceiling Said," and for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Connects us is one.